Welcome to the Financial Markets Insights podcast brought to you by the Realization Group, where we bring together the best minds in the financial and capital markets industry to discuss all the latest trends and news. I'm your host, Helen Disney, and today I'll be in conversation with our other regular podcast host, Jan Apache, who is also an originating member of the Digital Pound Foundation. In this episode, Jana and I will discuss why the UK might need a digital pound, what is a central bank digital currency, or CBDC, and what are its benefits as well as its possible risks for us as consumers and citizens. So hello and welcome to this episode of Financial Markets Insights. I'm here today with our guest speaker, Jan Apache, who is normally my co-host on the podcast, but today is representing the Digital Pound Foundation, her role as one of the originating members of the organisation. So welcome, Jana.
Hello, Helen. It's interesting to be on the other side of the fence.
Yeah, we're doing this a bit differently today, but the work of the Digital Pound Foundation is so interesting, and I think it might be great just to start by telling listeners a little bit about what the foundation is and why it was set up.
Sure. Yeah. So the Digital Pound Foundation it's been a while in the making. I think we first wrote a paper introducing the concept of what we then called the DGBP initiative back in about July, August 2020. And this was around the time that the Digital Dollar Project was set up in the US. It was launched in the US. And one of my fellow originating team members, Lee Schneider, knew a few people from that and said, why don't we do something similar in the UK? So that's how we sort of kicked off following from their example. And we started with the intention of looking at advocacy around and promotion of a well-designed digital pound of the UK, and I'll come on to that in a bit, with a focus on CBDC, so central bank digital currency. However, as we started to build interest from our founder members, who are all corporates, and also as a result, following on from some of our conversations with the Bank of England itself, we realized that in the UK, the future is likely to be a mixture of both public and private forms of digital money. So public meaning central bank issued money, and private meaning private institution issued money, such as e-money, for example, or fiat-backed stable coins. So on that basis, we decided that the Digital Pound Foundation would be established with the intent to promote the development of a well-designed digital pound in the UK and a healthy and diverse ecosystem for new forms of digital money more generally. And when we talk about a well-designed digital pound, what we really mean here is a digital pound that adheres not only to kind of best practices and standards that are internationally being developed around both public and private new forms of digital money, but also some of the well-established legal and social principles in the UK around proportionality of privacy, for example, and security and financial inclusion and things like that.
So I think it's really important that we've got an independent body like that, because obviously the future of money is changing, essentially. We're moving digital, we're moving away perhaps from cash, whether it's people just using other forms of digital payment or whether it's actually having a digital currency issued by a central bank. So can you just explain a bit about what is a central bank digital currency? Because I guess people tend to assume, well, look, I can pay for something with PayPal, or, you know, I can pay with Apple Pay, all these kind of electronic forms of payment. So what's the difference between that and a central bank digital currency?
Sure. So as you've pointed out, Helen, most of the time in these days, our transactions are not in cash. We are transacting electronically, using digital representations of money, whether in account form, between our banks, and using different payment providers as well. And from the outside, you would look at this and think, well, it is all digital already, so why do we need a central bank digital currency? And the answer is, if we think back to the systems on which our current payments infrastructure is built, they have some, you know, they've grown organically over the years, over decades, perhaps the best part of a century by now. And they're based on some pretty old, outdated assumptions. So for example, while today's banks are not exchanging wheelbarrows full of cash at the end of the day, some of the payment systems, you know, at their very core, have an assumption from decades back that wheelbarrows full of cash would be exchanged. And there has been some modernization over the intervening years to move on from that, to allow instantaneous settlement between accounts. Well, not instantaneous, but more real-time settlements between account transfers, for example. But these are not inherent properties of the system. And if we think about the technology that we have today and the requirements that we have today of money, if we were to sit down today and think, if I was designing money from scratch and I was looking at how we want to use money and how we want to make payments and transact between individuals, between businesses, etc., in today's world, and gathered the requirements for that, and then looked at the technical solutions that could be produced given the technology we have today, what we would come up with might look very different to the payment systems that we have on our legacy infrastructure now. And that's basically what central bank digital currency is. It's the design and implementation of a digital native form of central bank issued currency.
Well and good, but it sounds like it's really about the Bank of England modernising and the other commercial banks that work with the Bank of England, you know, moving into the 21st century. So does it really just affect those people already involved in the financial system? Or should we care about it as citizens? Does it actually have an impact on me as an individual living in the UK?
That's a really interesting question, Helen. And I think if we constrain ourselves to considering the benefits case for central bank digital currency just in the context of modernising the domestic payment system in the UK, then it does actually become more difficult potentially to make a case for why we should be looking into this now. However, there are broader benefits, and I think it helps to look back at where all the interest in central bank digital currency came from originally. So it was really Facebook, as it was then, their announcement of what was then Libra, their proposed proprietary stablecoin, back in June 2018, or was it 2019? Time is blurring with COVID. 2019, that catalyzed the central bank's interest in central bank digital currency. And one of the reasons for this was the potential impact of a private provider the size of Facebook, or Meta as it now is, having access to a user base that numbers in the billions and having all of them able to transact in this private form of digital money. And so central banks have looked at the potential for introducing new forms of digital money, both stablecoins and CBDC, traditionally, not only in the context of the modernization of payment systems, but also in terms of wider social and economic impacts that could arise from their introduction, as well as their potential as a platform for innovation more widely. And at the Digital Pound Foundation, this is one of the areas that we really try to promote, the potential of CBDC as a platform for innovation in the future. And if you, for example, take it in combination with other emerging technologies, such as the Internet of Things, artificial intelligence and machine learning, distributed ledger technology, we can have applications in the future that may not be foreseeable today, much as, to give an analogy that Sir John Cunliffe of the Bank of England has given in the past, at the time that the first iPhone was produced, no one could really have foreseen the potential impact of it that we've since seen across society today.
So I guess it's like a platform in a way, isn't it? And that platform could go in a number of different directions. I suppose the confusing part for the individual is, what is the difference really between all these different types of money? So we've talked about a central bank digital currency. We've talked about Meta or Facebook having its own coin, which would sort of essentially make them bigger than governments. They could issue their own money. And they've obviously got, as you said, a huge user base. So there's privacy questions around that, which we'll come back to. And then, there's obviously also a cryptocurrency, which is something different. So can you just explain a bit about what is a stable coin? Because you mentioned Libra, which has now been given the different name Diem, and it's a stable coin. So what's the difference between that and a cryptocurrency and a digital pound?
Sure. So I think there were sort of two things that you referred to, and I'd like to come back to the first later on, which is, from the individual's perspective, should I care and do I care? But first to go through the differences between a cryptocurrency, a stable coin, and a central bank digital currency. So a cryptocurrency like Bitcoin, for example, is typically, and not always, so don't take this as the definitive description of it. It's basically a form of currency which is not linked to the value of anything else, which is basically an emergent property of a blockchain or distributed ledger and enables the functioning of that blockchain or distributed ledger. And its value is derived purely from supply and demand. So whether buyer where buyers and sellers see its value being residing. A stable coin, on the other hand, is can be built on a blockchain or DLT technology, but it is not native to a blockchain in the same way that a cryptocurrency is. And a stable coin is basically something that derives its value from the value of something else. Now, that could be actually asset-backed. So, for example, the stable coin issuer could be holding a pound, for example, for every pound-denominated stable coin that it issues. Or it could be algorithmically derived in various ways. It could be synthetically pegged to something, or it's there's various other ways in which stable coins can operate. Now, when we talk about new forms of digital money, we refer specifically to those stable coins that derive their value from an underlying fiat currency, so a government-issued currency. And typically, we would also expect, and this is in line with regulatory developments worldwide, that it should be largely backed by that currency. And then finally, central bank digital currency. So while stable coins are all very well and good, they are issued by private issuers. So these are private companies, and therefore the holder of a stable coin is exposed to counterparty risk. And that's the risk that the issuer might go down, in which case the holder of the stable coin could be holding something that's worthless. And yes, there's regulation that can be implemented such that the holder of the stable coin is guaranteed to have some ability to recover the funds and things like that. But a central bank digital currency, on the other hand, eliminates that counterparty risk altogether by having central bank issued digital native currency. And some people have compared retail CBDC as more akin to cash. So basically, it from a use case perspective and an application perspective, it could make more sense to think about it as a digital cash. That allows the same functionality as cash today, but with more as well, given that it's digital native. Can I go back to what you said, what you'd mentioned earlier about the user experience?
Absolutely, yeah, because I think now that we've sort of sorted out, what's the differences between these different types of digital money, one thing that people are really interested in is what will it be like for me as an individual if we had a digital pound? How would it affect my daily life?
Sure. So the question, should I care what I'm transacting in? I would say people don't really at the moment. I mean, there's an obvious distinction between whether you're transacting electronically or you're transacting in cash, because cash is tangible and it's something that you hold in your hand. But in reality, I think most members of the general public remain blissfully unaware of the nature of the money that they're actually using right now. And what's really interesting is over the last 20 to 30 years, we've seen this increasing shift away from cash transactions to electronic transactions, to the point where, among retail users, the vast majority of transactions now occur electronically. And these electronic transactions are not happening in central bank money anymore, which is what cash was, because cash was represented a direct claim on the central bank. They're happening in commercial bank money, which represents a claim on the commercial bank, not the central bank. And yes, it may be underwritten by the Financial Services Compensation Scheme up to a certain amount, but it is also a private form of money in the same way that stablecoins are a private form of money as well. Now, day to day, do I think about this when I'm doing bank transfer or when I'm taking money out and using cash? Do I think about the nature of it? No, I don't. I use what's most effective for the transaction in which I'm engaging at the time. And that, I think, is how different forms of money should be in the future. We use what's fit for purpose at the time, but we don't necessarily have to think a lot about the underlying nature of it, either because it's central bank digital currency or because it's commercial bank money exchanged electronically as it is today, with all the regulatory protections in place behind it, or because it's a stablecoin or a private new form of digital money, again, appropriately protected by regulatory requirements and things like that. So I don't think that in an ideal scenario, an individual should be thinking too deeply about what they're transacting with. They should be able to have the certainty that whatever they're transacting with is secure and stable and reliable for them.
Yeah, and I guess, this is the interesting thing really, is how this whole concept of digital money has evolved, because in a way, the arrival of Bitcoin back in 2019, though Bitcoin has its volatility and it has its other concerns that people have about it, what it did show is that, there's this ability to actually do things in a more kind of rapid, frictionless way in some respects. And, what's happened now is that obviously, both private companies and governments want to emulate that and take advantage of its benefits. So in a way, stablecoin is a sort of hybrid attempt to kind of make cryptocurrency more palatable, if you like. You've got a currency that's digital, but it isn't as volatile as something like Bitcoin or other cryptocurrencies. But it does have this concern that, if you take, going back to the Libra Diem example, it's Facebook, it's Meta, which now is your bank, and obviously Facebook already knows a huge amount about us. So do we want that same company, also knowing what we're spending and who we're exchanging money with? But equally, some people might say, well, I don't particularly want the government to know what I'm spending and who I'm exchanging money with either. So if we think about whether it's our own government or other governments around the world that are thinking about or experimenting with issuing digital currency, there are risks, aren't there? What about the threat to our privacy? And, how are different countries addressing that?
You're right. There are risks, and I think CBDC draws out the concept of CBDC draws out some really interesting questions about the differences between individual jurisdictions and the kind of their essential characteristics and what a society might want to look like in the future. So, as you've mentioned, the potential risk associated with leaning too far towards allowing private sector operators and issuers of private stablecoins to fill the gap for digital money. is that some of them could also be large-scale data collectors, and the information that they are able to access and synthesize would be incredibly revealing about most people. And yet, to be quite honest, I think many people, if Diem had, or Libra as it was originally, Diem as it is now, if Diem was introduced as a means of exchange on Facebook's or Meta's platforms, I don't think that the majority of people would really question the nature of it. I think it would be the ease of use that primarily incentivized them to use it. But nevertheless, when we're considering public digital money in the form of central bank digital currency, the extent to which privacy is protected and enshrined in both the legislation around the CBDC as well as the design of the CBDC is going to be really fundamental to the type of society we want to live in the future. And different jurisdictions are addressing the challenges of privacy in different ways. So from a design perspective, there are different design choices that can be made in order to protect privacy. For example, small transactions and allow peer-to-peer transactions at the smaller scale. I think there's all too often an artificial dichotomy created between privacy and financial and prevention of financial crime. These two things do not have to exist in opposition. There are design choices that can be made that both allow for prevention and detection of financial crime whilst also providing sufficient privacy protections for individuals when transacting with each other.
I mean, it's come a long way, hasn't it, from, you know, Bitcoin, which was money without government, supposedly, you know, that we'd transact with each other peer to peer and there wouldn't need to be a middleman, to now suddenly the government's issuing digital currency. And I guess, you know, from a libertarian perspective, people just throw their hands up and say, well, I don't want the government in my digital wallet knowing everything that I do and potentially maybe using this as a way to collect, you know, taxes off me that I don't want to pay, or, you know, just knowing so much about me. What are the kind of counter arguments to that? I mean, you've said it can be designed in a way that protects privacy. What's the benefits? I mean, is it that governments are able to issue, you know, welfare benefits more effectively? Because we know the welfare system is a very blunt instrument and often payments get delayed and people who desperately need the money don't get it in good time. So what would be the, you know, the sort of counter arguments to the concern about privacy?
So central bank digital currency can bring with it a whole host of benefits. And I think another key thing to bear in mind is that, as I said at the beginning of this, the UK is probably going to exist in on a spectrum of private and public new forms of digital money. And it may not be that central bank digital currency is the solution to all of the use cases and potential applications for digital money. Different stable coins might fulfill different roles, for example, offer different levels of programmability, which is one of the key potential benefits of new forms of digital money. CBDC might not be all things to all people, but if a CBDC was to be implemented, it could be designed in such a way that it supported a degree of programmability, either restricted to certain types of user or programming entity, or made more broadly available to businesses as well, for example. And this could be used in a range of different ways for better allocation of benefits, to more effectively distribute helicopter payments, as you mentioned, for better policy delivery in a number of sectors. And, you know, tax collection, although not everyone's favorite use case, more effective and efficient tax collection at the point of transaction, for example, could actually reduce the overhead for many people reduce the overall tax burden. And tax collection is actually an important part of, you know, a citizen's relationship with the country that they live in. Yes, there are libertarians who would like to live in a world where that wasn't the case, but looking realistically at it, by having by introducing CBDC that did have certain characteristics, we may be able to deal with many of the current issues today, not only with respect to taxation for individuals, but for corporates as well. So, you know, there's a lot of focus on corporations not paying their due shares and things like that. And there's the potential to address and remediate some of these things as well. But there's also wider potential usages too. So for example, there's the potential ability to combine CBDC with other technologies, as I mentioned, to enable internet to the Internet of Things to further develop, and more of a fractionalized payment system. We could also.
Can you give some examples of that? You know, what would that look like in practice if someone was going to benefit from that? What's an example you could give?
Well, I think it's more of an extension of the. Sorry, I've forgotten what that thing is called now. You might want to stop recording for a second. Okay. So. Over the last 20 years or so, we've also seen the emergence of more of a subscription economy, which has enabled a wider range of services to be made available by businesses to a more diverse range of clients and participants. And combined with the Internet of Things, the subscription economy model could be taken to a new level where basically consumers are able to pay only for what they use, for example, and CBDC, which could be attached to wallets associated with objects or applications, etc., would be the enabler of this kind of more advanced subscription-based model. So that's one of the potential applications from more of an innovation perspective. At its simplest, though, I think we need to look back at what Facebook was originally trying to do with DM, which was actually just to enable peer-to-peer payments between users wherever they were in the world to each other, in a simple, reliable way that was easily integrated with many of the common applications that they use today. And that remains a very powerful use case. That's not something that's easy to do right now with the payments infrastructure that we've got. Yet it doesn't reflect, that current payments infrastructure doesn't really reflect the way that in a global economy and global society, people do transact with each other or how they do need to exchange value, which is currently very fragmented. So the creation of CBDC could also enable the provision of more integrated and accessible services in that way as well.
So is that things like sort of payments across borders? Because I'm thinking if other countries have digital currencies, how does that work? How would I, say I'm traveling to France and I've got my digital pounds, how can I then get some, you know, digital euros and interact with the currency in another country?
So I think it's important to recognize that no country at present has thought of extending its retail CBDC beyond its borders, and cross-border payments and the sort of FX side of things probably does get more into the wholesale use cases. So the use cases between financial institutions, for example. I think, however, when it's taken in combination with other advances in digital money, such as private stable coins and private operators, those could potentially provide the rails by which that sort of interoperability could be achieved between wallets in one digital currency and wallets in another, for example.
That's really, really interesting. And I think There's obviously been some skepticism, not just from the kind of public debate, but from policymakers around digital pound, including I think the House of Lords bringing out a report this week, which was somewhat more skeptical about it. So, what do you see as the current prospects for digital pound in terms of if it's going to happen, how long it's going to take to happen, and what do you think will happen over the rest of this year in terms of how it's going to move forward in the UK?
Sure. Well, as I said, when we talk about the digital pound, we don't only mean a central bank digital currency in the UK. We also mean the emergence of private stable coins, potentially systemically important stable coins that represent the value of the pound. And with respect to the latter, I think that is something that will happen regardless of what happens in the public sector. So HMT, for example, consulted last year on its the regulation of crypto assets and stable coins, clearly anticipating that this would be a growth area in the UK going forwards. And I think that from a central bank digital currency perspective, while the House of Lords report was not overwhelmingly supportive, shall we say, it's also important to bear in mind its context from a policy perspective. So last year, for example, the Chancellor announced the creation of the joint HMT Bank of England task force to look into the development of a central bank digital currency in the UK. And the House of Lords Economic Affairs Committee report actually took the form of a series of questions that it posed based on the evidence that it had heard for that task force to answer. Now, the task force is not actually under any obligation to answer those questions, but actually, if we look in more detail, we see that the task force is addressing many of those questions, as are the Bank of England engagement and technology forums, and as have the Bank of England's recent discussion papers on both retail CBDC and new forms of digital money over the past couple of years. So I think that from a private sector perspective, the UK will likely move forward, keeping a pace with the rest of the world. Whereas from a public sector perspective, this is more politically motivated, and we and the rate at which we progress is going to largely depend on political sentiment.
Well, it'll be really, really interesting to see the output from the Digital Pound Foundation. I know you're going to be debating a lot of these issues in some upcoming webinars and blogs and other pieces of work. So thank you very much for coming on and explaining this quite complicated landscape to us, Jana. I think it'll be eye-opening for people to just understand, first of all, as you say, what the differences are between these different forms of money and then also some of the implications they might have on us. So we're looking forward to continuing this discussion, and I'm sure we'll be having you back to talk about more developments on this over the coming months. But for now, thank you very much for being with us on this episode, and we look forward to hearing you back as host on the next session of Financial Markets Insights podcast.
Thank you very much, Helen, and I look forward to it too.
Thanks to all our listeners for joining us. You've been listening to the monthly Financial Markets Insights podcast hosted by me, Helen Disney. Subscribe to the podcast to stay informed of all our future shows, or you can sign up for our newsletter to get all the latest updates from the Realization Group at therealizationgroup.com. That's the Realization, REALIZATION group.com. See you next time for more Financial Markets Insights.